You guys started?
Yeah. All ready to go.
Cool. 45 minutes.
Let's take this off. Come up here. Let me get comfortable. You want to put me on the hot seat.
Okay. Let's start with some basic questions first.
Okay.
How long has your family, been in Roanoke? How many generations? Just wondering.
Three generations in my family. Been here in Roanoke. We're from the Pennsylvania County, Danville area, and we sort of migrated here to Roanoke. My grandmother moved here first, and then a grandfather moved here, and then my father followed himself. So that's how we ended here.
It took a while, I guess.
Yeah, it did.
So where did you grow up in, which area of Roanoke?
In the upper southwest side of Roanoke, Roy Avenue, 13th Street, Salem Avenue, in that area, in that general area there. Yeah.
So, when you were a kid, where would you hang out with?
When I was growing up, we hung out with the neighborhood kids, in our immediate neighborhood, and there were lots of children that lived on my street, lots of young families. So on my street and the street over, and that's who we played. We played with kids right there from the immediate neighborhood. Occasionally we might go to a party when I was a teenager over in the northwest, side of town, but mostly we stayed in our area.
Your father and mother, what did they do for a living?
My father was a supervisor down at the Roanoke Gas Company. He started out as a laborer down there and just moved up to the ranks. Mm-hmm. He's deceased now, but he rose to, I think they call him distribution supervisor down there. Mm-hmm. And my mother's always been a housewife. And she, in the summer sometimes she would work part-time jobs, something like at a dry cleaner's or, something like that. But mostly, she was a homemaker. She stayed at home with six of my family, so lots of children to take care of. Lots of cooking and cleaning and washing.
And where do you come in with this?
I'm next to the oldest. I'm the second in line. Mm-hmm.
And so you have five siblings. How many?
There's three boys and three girls in my family.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And any tensions going on or?
No, we were very close. I think there are almost 2.5 between my sister and I, and then there are 2 years between on down the line, except for when we get to my baby sister, my the youngest, mm-hmm. and there are 7 years between she and my baby brother. Mm-hmm. So it was a big. That was a oops. Another child. Where did that child come from? So anyway. So the rest of us are very close in age, and we've always gotten along very well because of the fact that we are so close in age. So,
anyway. And when you were a teenager, did you have to get a job or anything, or did you just?
No, I just went to school. My job was going to school, really, and naturally we had chores around the house to take care of. I really didn't get my first job until I was probably the summer when I was 15, probably. Mm. I worked for a contractor part-time, typing and, just part-time. He really didn't have an office. He would bring the work by my home and I would, do the work. He'd come back and pick it up. Mm. So the first real job I had, I was 16. The summer I was 16. Mm. Actually got paid. I mean, he paid me too, but it was just a small amount. But I had an hourly wage and everything. I'm 16,
For my the history topic that I wanted to study was how did the Great Depression and the New Deal era sort of affect Roanoke's lifestyle? Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if from either your parents' perspective or your perspective, if you could sort of tell me how those, either the New Deal programs, like the WPA or the CCC, affected your family as, like, as far as jobs or, like, income goes?
You know, when you're young, you really don't think of those things if your parents don't really discuss them with you.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really never, you know, I guess, exposed to those kind of conversations in my house.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't really know how to answer that without firsthand, because I really had no real firsthand experience with it.
Mm-hmm.
My father was always the kind of guy that worked very hard and had good work ethics, so, and people usually just liked him, you know. I'm sure he experienced probably a lot, but I did not, so, you know, I don't know how to answer that. Maybe my sister might be able to, but I just can't answer it.
Next question is, like, when you started growing up, when did you start, like, looking outside of Roanoke from just your area? Like, when did you start hearing about, like, I guess, like, Vietnam or something like that? Like,
well, my husband is a Vietnam vet, and I was much older when that Vietnam War, you know, started. I'm 60.
Okay,
so that was during my era. My husband was a Vietnam. He was in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
He was a staff sergeant in the Army. So I experienced that, the Vietnam War. And the toll it took on the toll that it took on the lives of friends that I went to school with and grew up with and people that lived in the neighborhood. So lots of conversation about that war, and so give me your question again. So now that you know that.
I was just wondering what was the first big world event that really
affected me?
Yeah, affected you.
It wasn't the Vietnam War. I think really what really affected me and really made me take a look at how people felt about other people was when John F. Kennedy was assassinated. That really just had a profound effect on me. It was almost like he was a part of our families, you know, because he did so much to make things better, you know, for my generation of folks. So that had a, you know, I was really, really affected, you know, by that, his death. And then the next one was probably Martin Luther King.
Mm.
You know, so there are some things that happened historically, you know, that affects young people maybe in different ways, but it made me think and see the world a lot differently. You know, sometimes we have these idealistic ideas about the world and people and all those kind of things. Some things you're not really confronted with, you know, head on, but they're out there, but you're just not aware of them. And I guess we just don't think about them because of our ages and our family situation, you know, how you lived and what you experienced, you know. And if you don't, you know, if it's not there, and, you know, you just don't think about it. You know, I have older friends that, you know, they marched, you know, and they did things like that that I never had to do, you know. I can remember walking into a restaurant once and someone asking us to go to the side door, but we were like, we're not going to the side door to the restaurant. We want to eat it. Either you want our money or you don't want our money, you know. So, I mean, that's the kind of attitude that we had, you know, and it was, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so maybe, I think that was good, I think, for us, because for my generation anyway, the kids that I grew up with, we just, I guess, we'd gotten to the point where we were not in situations that caused us to have to do that very often. You understand what I mean? Mm-hmm. So we knew how to deal with it, I guess, or we didn't. We were just too naive, or you know, just, you know what I mean. So,
Before the assassination of JFK, what exactly changed for you? Because I know you said you viewed people differently, but
I don't know. I think before that we just sort of lived in our own little world, and I say to you, we just didn't watch TV. We didn't do things that you young people do now. Mm-hmm. We didn't have the internet and all those kind of things. I mean, we came home, we did our homework, we had supper, and then we were outside until it got dark and it was time for us to come in and get our baths or whatever, and we went to bed. Mm-hmm. We didn't watch TV. Even on the weekends, we just didn't watch TV. We would read or, we're out playing with our friends or doing something like that. I don't know, maybe we lived in a little close-in world or something. And then, with six children, you don't do a lot of traveling and, and stuff like that. And we didn't really listen to the radio a lot. We just kind of entertained ourselves. And, my father, he worked very, very hard and was probably pretty astute, with what was happening out in the world. But he just didn't bring that home. We were just not exposed to all the bad stuff. So unless it was something like an assassination that you talked about in school or, on the bus conversation, with other kids that maybe were as exposed to that kind of thing, mm-hmm. more readily than we were. I don't know. I guess we just lived in a in a closed little, secure area. Mm-hmm. And you probably don't hear that very much, but it's true. Just we were, We were very family-oriented kind of people. We stayed in the same, general vicinity of each other, and we socialized together, and the children played together, and we went to the same church together, and we just, mm-hmm. live that kind of life. And nothing interesting at all. So, but once the assassination, we were getting older too. So yeah. You were hearing more and you were doing more outside of that little circle. Mm-hmm. You were studying more in school about, those kind of issues and world events and those kind of things. So as you got older, naturally you became more aware and I guess more, conscious of, of social issues and what was happening in the world. But that makes sense. I'm boring.
you did bring up something that I wanted to ask you about. I know from my family experience that church has always been one of the centers of my life, where we get together with friends, have picnics and whatnot.
Yes.
And I was just wondering, if that was, I guess, more so with you all, mm-hmm. just because you were segregated and you didn't have the same opportunities to have entertainment other people did. So
absolutely, the church was a very, very, very important part of your existence. When I was growing up, as far as meeting different teens from other communities. Usually they would come from Northwest over to Southwest, the church I attended. So you got to meet someone not out of a school setting without, mm-hmm. Usually you meet them at school, but, they would go home and you would go home and you wouldn't see them anymore. But at least on Sunday or we had a church event or something, they would, come. And I don't know, as you got older, it got better because you sort of, you would go to a party maybe over in Northwest or whatever, or attend a game of some kind, football or basketball. And so the circle widened, you widen your circles. But growing up, until I became a teenager, that didn't happen, very mm-hmm. much. So the church was a key part of my upbringing. It was very, it's not, it seemed like church is not, now it's, it's like flip-flop. church is something you put on the back burner. For mm-hmm. us, it was a very important part of what was happening in our community, and it sort of held the community together too, I think.
I was wondering, just out of curiosity, how long did your church services normally last on Sunday?
Like a couple of hours.
A couple of hours?
Mm-hmm. Usually a couple of hours, and we had Sunday school too, you know, so if you went to Sunday school. And sometimes we'd go to Sunday school and not go to church. You know, my parents would go to church and we'd come back home. My sister, you know, older, especially when we got a little older, you know, we lived right up the street from the church, so sometimes we would not stay for church. We would go to Sunday school, you know, early in the morning, and then come home. Church. And we used to have Sunday dinner, and people would come over, you know, for Sunday dinner. Other family members that you didn't see during the week would usually come, you know, for dinner on Sunday. So, my brothers and sisters, the younger brothers and sisters, they went to integrated schools because that's when they integrated schools when the year before I graduated from high school. But all my brothers and sisters at least spent 1 year or more in integrated schools, when my school was entirely African American. You know, and my neighborhood was entirely African American. That was a change. And the first job that I ever had, I was one of the few African Americans hired by the city of Roanoke at the time. And this was like in 1972. Since that time, since integration, in the early beginning of integration, when businesses and, you know, those kind of things were starting to happen, you were always very few African Americans, you know, in jobs at banks or, you know, schools and all those kind of things, except for our school, you know, which was all African American. But, you know, I know there were great separations at one time, you know, but I never really had to experience that, I guess, the suffering that some people experienced in, you know, growing up in that time.
From what I was reading of the bio that I found on you from the school board, they said you're the child advocate?
Court appointed special advocate for the juvenile court system.
I was just wondering if you could tell me a little about what that is specifically, because I've never heard of that.
So. Okay. We advocate what's in the best interest of a child. Say, for instance, did you all hear about the case where the young lady, her baby was born at home, and she left the baby in the closet at home and went to work? You heard about that case?
I didn't know.
You did?
No.
That was one of my cases. I advocated for the baby. They found the baby 2 or 3 days after the baby was born. They took the baby to Lewis Gale, and the baby was in Lewis Gale over 2 months, close to 3 months. A judge appoints an advocate for that child to make a determination as to where that child should be placed. So there's a list of CASA workers or advocates, and the judge appoints you to that child, and you investigate the families involved, the mother, any counseling services or anything that the parents or the mother was involved in. You have to investigate that, and then we do a court report that goes back to the judge to say, this is where I think this child should be placed. Well, right now, we need to leave that child in foster care until we find the proper home for that child. So you go by for home visits, you talk to the doctor, any professional person who is involved with that child, you talk to, you become that short-term, I guess, parent or advocate for that child. Mm-hmm. You talk to the social worker or any adult or anybody that's involved with that child, and you make suggestions to the courts. That child was my child. That was one of my children. The mother did not know who the father of that child was, and she just got sentenced to 2 years in prison. The mother did, and she was a from an abused home herself. So I followed that child. We found the father of the child. The child is doing great now. His birthday is July 15th, and he is thriving. And when you saw him, I would go to the NEO care unit and sit there and try to hold him. He didn't want you to be touched or anything because he got burns on his body from the afterbirth because she left him in the closet for 2 days or 3 days. We don't really know the exact birth date of the baby. So that's what I do. I look out for the best interests of, you know, a child in an abusive situation of some kind.
Mm-hmm. What made you get interested in this field of work?
In the school, in CASA, just a way to give back to the community. I always, you know, my parents always told us, you know, do something good for your fellow man. So always find something that you're passionate about, that you can volunteer for. And I just always had a passion for children, especially children who don't have someone to speak for them or look out for their best interests. So that was just one thing I chose, you know, even before I became a grandmother, you know, about Girl Scouts and, you know, with my Girl Scouts and just different things. I've already always been involved somehow with youth. Mm-hmm. And so I just enjoy doing that. I just have a passion for that.
Mm-hmm. I guess I can ask you a couple more questions about your experiences with Vietnam. And
Vietnam,
When your husband went over to see us, I was just wondering.
Okay, now my husband is a Vietnam era veteran. He was not actually in Vietnam. He ran a clinic. My husband is in radiology, and he actually ran a clinic over in Germany. But patients would come there from the war, and, you know, we had a big, well, we still have an army base over in Germany. So that's how, but he has friends, and I had neighbors that actually served in the war. And it really affected several of my really good friends. I just get sad thinking about it now. A lot of the veterans came back addicted to drugs of some kind because that's the only way they could deal with what happened, what they saw over there. And some of the stories, you know, that they told. And sometimes you... A vet, sometimes they just want to vent, and it's good to just listen to what they experience because, and it's hard for them to talk about some things. So I heard some horror stories. I have heard some horror things. So that war went on entirely too long. It did.
Yeah.
It really did, entirely too long.
And I was just wondering, like, how close were you with, like, I know for... Both my grandparents were in World War II, and for them, some of their family units, or some of the family in his unit, got together and sort of formed like a group, like a support group.
Was anything
like that with your unit or?
No, not really. There are four of them that stay in touch, and every so many years they try to meet someplace. Just to get together and to catch up. And my husband is still very close to those other three men, and they served together in Germany. The Vietnam neighbors that I shared the story, you know, some of the stories about them, they're deceased. I had three really close friends, males, who just one thing after another, just they're no longer here. So. But the three friends of my husband that they're real close to, they do stay in contact by telephone. And like I say, every couple of years or so, they meet. We get together and go someplace just for a long weekend. And last time we took a cruise together. We all met down in Florida, took a cruise together. So they do stay in touch with each other. So
I was also going to ask you, like, how much, like, I know since you had six children as in your family that you probably didn't travel much, but
oh no, we traveled to see, you know, relatives, you know, in Danville or someplace. Mm-hmm. And when I got a little older, my mother, her sister moved to New York, so I thought that was just we went to New York. So at least once a year we would go to New York. Not all of us, you know, usually we'd kind of rotate who was going, and we would go up to New York and spend, you know, not quite a week. We would go up in the summer Mm-hmm. And so I always look forward to that, you know, going to the big city and, you know, doing something different. But family-wise, you know, it was just routine trips. You know, we would go down to Pennsylvania, Danville area to visit, you know, family and friends down there. And, you know, you would take an occasional trip to a lake someplace for entertainment or, you know, something like that. But, mm-hmm. No, we couldn't afford to do what my grandchildren or, you know, my grown daughter, what we do now, you yeah. know. It's just out of the question. Forget it. Yeah. You know, so anyway. Mm-hmm.
We're living. When did your family own a car? I was just wondering.
Yes. Yeah. My daddy has always had a car. We've always had a car in the family.
What was the first model you remember?
Oh, my goodness. Let me see. The first one I remember, I can see it, but I just can't. I don't know what it... It was a Ford of some kind, but I don't remember what kind of Ford. I don't.
Is it sedan or...
It was a sedan.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I don't remember, though, the name of it. But we've always had a car.
Mm-hmm.
We've always had a phone. You know, we've always had a TV. We didn't watch it. You know, it was old black and white TV. And, you know, we always had a radio in the house, several of them, of radios. And, you know, I can remember my father listening to the fights. On radio, you know. That didn't interest me, but you know, I could remember him doing that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we just, you know, we were poor, but we didn't know we were poor. If that makes sense. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had always had, you know, food to eat, and we always, you know, had clothes. Maybe we didn't have the nicest clothes like everyone, but we were always, you know, told. You know, you always, your shoes are always clean and your clothes are always clean. So we were raised with good values, I think, values, you know, so didn't have a lot. I said we were poor, but we didn't know we were poor. I just thought everybody lived that way because everybody that we knew lived that way. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the way they lived, you know.
I was wondering, once you got in the high school area for sports, I was just wondering what kind of, like, if you had, like, inner-city competitions or...
We did. I ran track.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did have, it wasn't really inner-city. We'd have Saturday meets, and schools would come, you know, African-American school, black schools from other areas would come to either the Addison track field or we would go to Victory Stadium. I can remember, you know, going there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in competing in track. Now, my brothers, it was different for them. They had more opportunities, you know, for basketball. They all three played basketball, so they were all over the place, you know, when they were teenagers. Yeah. And then I had a sister. The baby sister was very good at basketball, too. And things had changed completely when she was hit high school. She played basketball all during her time in high school, too. And my older sister... it was more like choir, you know, and the band. You know what I mean? It was not the variety of sports that they have now. They just didn't have. I mean, like I said, they had football and they had basketball and they had track. You know, they didn't have golf and lacrosse and all those kind of things that we participated in.
Mm-hmm.
So, and usually you chose one thing and that's what you stuck with because, you know, parents didn't have the luxury of transporting you all over town for practices and all this kind of stuff. So, and with six, you can just imagine. I mean, you choose one thing, and if we can do that, that's what we'll do. But if we can't, you know. So normally, or you wrote it, you know, it was on a track team. So we walked every place, and we caught the bus. You know, your parents didn't drive you all over the place. You know, usually, you know, sometimes they drop you someplace and. You would catch the bus home, or you'd get a ride home, or something like that. So it's different.
Mm-hmm.
And now you all have an activity bus and all those kind of things. And we didn't have that kind of stuff growing up.
Mm-hmm. Kind of along those lines, for holidays and whatnot for like 4th of July or Christmas, like, was that like a community thing or was that a family?
Family. That was a family thing. No, and we still do it to this day, even with my father's passing. Thanksgiving, you know, all the brothers and sisters are there with their husband and wives or girlfriends or whatever, and children and grandchildren, and we, Thanksgiving and Christmas, the 4th of July, most major holidays, we are together as a family unit. Mm-hmm. And we're just come on, we don't mind anybody coming, you know, you come. But we are, as a unit, we will be together, you know, someplace. Now that my mother's up in her 80s, you know, normally we rotate our homes, you know, but it's usually a family gathering. Mm-hmm. We do that. We're very close-knit. Family is very close-knit.
And if, like, from those holidays, like, which, from as a kid, which ones do you, like, remember the most?
Christmas.
Uh-huh.
Because we didn't get toys like the kids got, you know, now I'm grandson or whatever, you know, Grammy, can I have so-and-so, you know, and you just buy it or whatever. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, that's the only time we really got, you know, something that we wanted. Bicycle or, you know, a special doll or, you know, special shoes or whatever. That was at Christmas time, so that was an exciting holiday for all of us, you know. So maybe not for my parents, but, you know, but it was always exciting, and they always made it, you know, very, you look forward to it because you knew you were going to get something that, you know, that was of importance. That you wanted all year and you couldn't get it. You knew that. You know, they always made it a lot of fun for us. You know, and sometimes, you know, we didn't get exactly what we wanted, but maybe something very similar. Mm-hmm. You know, so it was always a good time.
Do you have any, like, I guess hobbies would be the best word for it?
Hobbies?
Like carpentry and.
I love carpentry. I love to build things and to put tile up and, you know, and paint, and I love doing that. I don't have time to do a lot of that anymore, but I love doing that. I love decorating. I love to make things with my hands, and I'm very crafty. I love doing craft things, and but I don't have enough time now to do stuff like that. I love crossword puzzles and, you know, I like doing stuff like that with my hands, or, you know, I like to read when I have time. Now, just business kind of stuff, you don't have time for pleasure reading anymore, to read for pleasure, but I enjoy doing that too. And I just, you know, I enjoy people too. I enjoy, you know, doing things for people, and I like to go to a nursing home and, you know, see someone that maybe they don't have family to drop in, and, you know, I love to just drop by and give them a card and just kind of cheer them up for the day or something. I wish I had more time to do stuff like that, but that's what I like doing. I just, you know, I just kind of like making people happy sometimes, you know. Ordinarily might not have someone to, you know, to cheer them up a little bit, you know. So, anyway, like that.
Could I ask a question?
Yeah.
I know this is back to JFK, just a quick question, but I know my mother, she remembers exactly where she was during JFK, and, like,
I remember exactly where I was, too.
I remember exactly where I was when I heard about September 11th, and I know
it's the same kind of thing.
I was on 95, and I could see the smoke from the Pentagon.
Really?
Yeah, it was scary.
That was horrible. I was at work when that happened. I was sitting in my office, and someone ran in and said, someone just bombed the World Trade Center. And I said, you're kidding me. Don't joke like that. I'm serious. We got the TV on in the office there. It was just unbelievable. Unbelievable. But I was on a bus when I heard about JFK. I was on a bus. It just broke.
My mom said, I think she was in the classroom.
She was in the
classroom.
And
they just watched the TV all day. Everybody was crying.
I started crying on the bus. I just started crying. The bus driver, apparently he had a radio. I don't know how all of a sudden we were on the bus and he told us. And it just ruined my day. Ruined my, it was awful. I just thought, you know, how cruel people can, why would you do that? You know, it has happened many times since then, but that just is profound. And then, you know, and you're thinking, as what can I do to make the world better? What can I do to make people feel differently and think differently? You know, we don't all have to be alike, but we, you know, you want to do the right thing. You want to do, you know, what's right for everyone, for the people. And it just bothers me that people don't think that way. Now, I know we're all different and we should think differently, but, you know, ultimately we should all, you know, do what's in the greater good for everyone, you know, not for a select few. And that made me really think about that. Why would they do that? Why would any person do that? But anyway, sorry. I definitely remember exactly where I was, and the same thing with Martin Luther King. I just remember those.
How did your family sort of react to it? Like, what did your parents, how did your parents try to explain it to you when you got home? If they try.
You know, I don't remember them really trying a lot. Teachers did. You know, I can remember, you know, teachers trying to calm us and, you know, and trying to make us make sense of this. You know, there are cruel people out there and all. But I don't, you know, remember having a deep conversation with my parents about it. You know, I really don't. I don't. I'm sure they tried something, but, you know, I just can't remember what, you know, how what they did. But 9/11 was tough for you all. I mean, it was tough for me too, but that was probably one of the largest disasters, you know, where someone came into our country and killed and bombed. I mean, ran airplanes into. I mean, that was probably major for you all.
Mm-hmm.
You remember 9/11, do you? I know you're still a baby still, but as a young man, they probably, you know.
Seventh grade.
You were seventh grade? Okay.
Sitting in the science classroom.
Science classroom.
Sixth
where were you?
I was coming home.
You were that's right. You said you were 95.
I was on 95.
On 95.
Stuck in traffic.
Stuck in traffic. That was just mind-boggling to me. And I just couldn't stop watching it. You know, I watched it for days and days and days. My husband said, cut the TV off, honey. Stop listening to the news. Because I was crying. I was upset. You know, that just... I felt so bad for the people there, you know, for the families, for the people they couldn't find, and it still upsets me. It's just horrible, horrible. That never ever happens in anybody's lifetime again. We just have to prevent that from happening. But there are some mean folks out here. They're just mean people that, you know, and it's. I don't know, it's their thinking. You know, it's just the way they think. And it's just, you can't change that. It's happened for hundreds and hundreds of years, and it will, you know, like generation after generation after generation, how people think and feel about people, and, you know, and I don't think that'll ever go away. Just won't ever go away. But anyway, I'm sorry.
The other thing in your bio that I've thought was interesting was the second half after you retired from the Roanoke City and when you became president of the two different associations.
The American Business Women's Association.
It was,
that children are involved in that too. Somehow. The American Business Women's Association was really, it's a national organization that really their main function is to give scholarships to women at the time, young girls, and that was the focus. I like joining something with a purpose, and that their focus was to raise money to give out scholarships to young women who, hopefully, they were pursuing a business, you know, degree. And so that was my reason for joining the American Business Women's Association, and you know, I just you know became. Treasurer and vice president and then president of the organization, and I was in two different chapters, and we had the national convention here in Roanoke, and I was president of the Association for all the chapters here in our in the Roanoke Valley. That association, we also ran a bingo down at Hall down in Benton, and one year we gave, I think it was over $60,000 worth of scholarship, lots of money in bingo, just saved in scholarships to young women, you know, here in town. We don't do that anymore, but my purpose for joining American Business and Women was because of the children. Mm. It was an organization that had a purpose. There are lots of fraternities and lots of clubs and lots of organizations that you can belong to, but it's got to be meaningful for me in order for me to be associated with it or to be a member.
Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, for your experience as a school board member, how much has that, like, from these three different aspects, like, how much has your interaction with children changed with your as you gain experience?
The interaction is a little different. Mm-hmm. When I was doing American Business Women's Association, we didn't really interact with the children. We raised money. We'd see the kids once a year when we visited the scholarships. Mm-hmm. I volunteered as a mentor at Lincoln Terrace, so once a week I would leave my job and go there, like, for a couple of hours and tutor, you know, reading, math, whatever the child needs were at the time. So, but now with the children, I interact more. You know, there are 29 schools. I try to get around and visit all the schools as often as possible. Each board member, we have schools assigned to us, and so we try to attend their events. And there's a young lady that I'm co-mentoring here at Addison with another friend of mine. So there's more, I guess, interaction that way with the children. I think this is more, it's different, mm-hmm. you know. It's just a different way of interacting, the school board versus the American Business Women's Association. I think the reason why I got on the school board one night, we were with a group of friends out to dinner, and they had some openings on the board, and it was a lot going on, and we just felt like the school board was being ineffective, and they were not moving the district forward, and I went home mad. And I'm thinking, and then, you know, I thought to myself, we complain about things that people are not doing. What are we doing to make things better? I'm saying that to myself. And I'm thinking, we sat there and we complained for an hour about what they're not doing, you know? Mm-hmm. What am I doing? What am I doing, maybe, to make a difference in what's happening in the city schools? So the day before the deadline, that night of, I filled out that application. I got on the computer mad and filled out that application. Let's see. And I told my husband, he said, "May, I wouldn't do that." I said, "If it's meant to be, it's going to be. I'm not worrying about it. I'm putting the application in. If I'm chosen, hey, I'm up for the job. If I'm not, then I walk away. But I cannot sit at a table with other folks and say, this is what they should be doing, and they're not doing this, and, you know, they got all these schools, and they're complaining, we don't have any, you know." I said, then I could say I tried, but I could not get on the board. That's what made me join the board. Hmm. So, because we do that a lot, you know, as people. We complain, and we say, you know, well, so-and-so is not doing it. If you don't know what's involved, and then it's been an eye-opening experience for me, too. There are lots of things that people don't realize that you can't do. Mm-hmm. You do the best you can, and you try to make it better. That's all you can do. So, I hope that answered your question.
Yeah. I was from all these different jobs that you've had over the past week. Guys, 40 years, I guess. Mm-hmm. Like, which ones have, if you could, like, list the top five, which ones would, did you mean the most to you as?
Mean the most to me?
Yeah.
CASA.
CASA.
I would put that at the top, because mm-hmm. I really feel like that I've made a difference in a child's life. I put that child in a safe place. And I feel real good about that. I put a lot of effort into making sure that I make the right decision, right recommendation to a judge.
Mm-hmm.
And I always say a prayer that judge is going to listen, because he appoints you. You might not get the judge that appointed you, but you're hoping that he's really going to listen to what you recommend, and that child goes to a good home, a loving home, you know, someplace where they feel safe and they feel loved. You know, so that is the most rewarding thing I think I've done, and I've seen. You all just would not believe. That's very rewarding. I'd put that one first, and probably second. I like the school board. I like all the changes that we have made in this district with the changing the attendance zones and making our schools more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. I don't like the year that we're in now with all the budget uproar. We're $10 million down, and you know, you have to go in and start cutting staff and putting more kids in a classroom with a teacher, and mm-hmm. That bothers me. You know, it disturbs me to have to riff lay a person off from a job, you know, that you don't have the money for. And you know, it's going to hurt our children generations to come. So I think it's important work, and you know, I enjoy doing that too. So mm-hmm. Anything in my life that I've done, I've not enjoyed it. As that's the kind of person I am. You go in with a positive attitude, and I think you make, you know what I mean? You make things work for you, and hopefully for the betterment of someone else. Mm-hmm. So that's how I look at life. Right.
I know from class we've talked a little bit about the redistricting of the highway to go through Roanoke, and I was just wondering if that affected your family at all or
no, didn't affect us. But it did affect some folks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
Have you had to deal with any repercussions of it from being on the school board or anything?
No. I haven't. Is that still going?
Yes, that is still taping.
It's still taping. Tell me about your class. I'm sorry. I'm not questioning you now. Tell me about
Well, for the first half of the class, we just went over this book from Roanoke from 1882, I guess, to 1912.
Okay.
And it's just like a general overview of how Roanoke, what came from Big Lake to Roanoke.
So that is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I have a book at home. I think the mayor, our last mayor, Nelson Harris,
mm-hmm.
have you read his book?
I think it was.
Okay, I think it's something in that book too, but I haven't read it, but anyway. I digress, I'm sorry.
And then the second half, we're doing a research paper on after Roanoke based on these interviews.
That's interesting. Okay.
My personal topic is going to be on the New Deal and how that affected the social structure and different, I guess, the job market and stuff like that in Roanoke.
So. Well, it was hard, you know, even in the 70s to find a job if you were African American, mm-hmm. you know, because the doors were still closed, you know. But the federal government said, okay, open the doors up, you know. Mm-hmm. We have to let folks in, and so with the special job grants and those kind of things that were out there and made available,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think it pushed a lot of companies into opening doors, you know, to allow people of different races to come in and work and to prove themselves. But a lot of opportunities were, you know, closed to minority folks mm-hmm. here in town. But
I was wondering when, for, I know the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and 65 were both passed on a federal level, but how much like actual impact did it have on Roanoke area?
It had a great impact on the integration of the schools.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have that document when the schools were integrated?
Not with me at the present, but it's on my
You
computer.
Do have it?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's on my computer.
It's a lot of history in that document. You read mm-hmm. that on the schools, so it had a big impact on the schools.
How about with the job market? Like, did it really do much, or is it?
Something, but you know, I mean, it's much better today. But when mm-hmm. then, you know, and that's not really. I mean, they were forced to. So you went in to a situation where, you know, things were not always what they seem. You know, people were always in the background. You know, holding people down and keeping them, you know, in their own place. If that's, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was not an easy time for some folks. So,
mm-hmm.
but attitudes have changed. It's still there. Mm-hmm. It's just undercover. It's not as much of it.
Yeah.
You know, things are better, but it's still there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, still there. So,
I was just wondering for, like, I guess, if did you remember, like, because I know we've talked a lot about the Greensboro section of Roanoke and how that was, like...
Gainesboro.
Mm-hmm. And how that had, like, its own, like, business district.
It did.
And I was just wondering if you knew anything about that, like, after...
No, because, see, I didn't live in that Gainesboro area.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in Southwest, and we were sort of isolated up there. I mean, we had little community stores on a corner, you know, mm-hmm. here and there, but not the volume of businesses that are there, that's right. down there, in that was down there in that area at the time. I mean, they had, First Street, restaurants and a movie theater and, you know, and all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
Some retail, you know, there. And if we did come down, you know, sometime we would go down to the movies on Saturday or Sunday, and we did, you know, patronize the restaurants or something, you know, on Saturday or something, we might go down. It might be a treat, not often, you know, but anyway, that was a treat to go down and get mm-hmm. a hot dog and a drink, which was probably 25 cents or something like that at the time. You know, so we knew the existence, you know, that there were areas in the city, but I just didn't live there. You know, my everyday existence was not a part of that community where mm-hmm. people that actually lived down there in that area, you know, it was a part of their culture, you know, that area there. But mm-hmm. was just kind of removed from it, you know, somewhat. I told you all, I'm boring. I'm boring. And my husband had a cousin who lived in that Gainesboro area. And he lived in Salem. My husband's from Salem.
Mm-hmm.
And he was almost sort of isolated himself. But when he would come down on the weekend,
mm-hmm.
you know, he's talked about, you know, things that they used to do and, you know, some of his experiences,
mm-hmm.
You know, something, you know, things that he experienced as a youth, you know, down in that area. But I just never really got a lot of exposure to that area, so.
I was wondering, once you got, like, when you became independent from your family and started working out on
mm-hmm.
your own,
mm-hmm.
where do you start, like, to like gravitate towards, or did you stay in the same place, or did you like
move? I moved to Salem. My husband is from Salem, so I moved to the Salem area and lived there before moving back down to Roanoke. I think when he got out of the military, we came back down to Roanoke to live. And Salem is a pretty quiet place. If you all know, Salem is just kind of quiet. It's quiet.
How much different is Salem from? Is it like the small town Roanoke?
No.
Or is it? Or is it completely different?
It's completely different. Mm-hmm. Roanoke is really an urban city. It's just a small urban city. Mm-hmm. Salem is more rural. Not in the land, but you know what I mean. It's the people are more close-knit. It's smaller. It's a smaller community. Mm-hmm. It's different. Mm-hmm. It's a lot different than Roanoke, I think. And then, you know, Roanoke, people come to Roanoke because we have services available for them. You know, we have social services and, you know, housing help, you know, and that's mm-hmm. why we have, you know, you can come to Roanoke and find some place to live cheaply. You know, we have the housing projects and housing areas where, you know, subsidized housing where people can, you know, come and hopefully find a job and live. Salem, you know, you're not going to be able to do that. They have some services, but not the number of services that we offer here in Roanoke. You know, we have public transportation, so people can buy a bus pass and get around. You know, they can get around in this area pretty easily. Then Salem, you know, they don't have a, you know, public transportation. So, you mm-hmm. know, so our population is a lot different. Probably most of the people in Salem who live there are, I would say, middle income and above, probably. Mm-hmm. Poverty is not, you know what I mean? It's, yeah. I mean, it's there, mm-hmm. but it's not to the degree that it is here in Roanoke. Mm-hmm. Roanoke, we're able to offer people services, you know, and that's why people flock to Roanoke. Mm-hmm.
And another question about the Salem area, and pertains to, like, you mentioned how it was, like, a lot closer, and I was just wondering, like, if from the church aspect that you mentioned mm-hmm. earlier, like, would that same concept be in Salem as it was in Roanoke, or... I don't know.
My husband is Jehovah. Well, his family was Jehovah Witness, okay. and they are very close knit. Mm-hmm. If mm-hmm. you don't know anything about, they're very close knit, and they are still. His cousins are still practicing witnesses, and they are still very close knit. I think as a family church unit, mm-hmm. you know, they are. They do a lot of things together, and they help each other a lot, and. You know, I can only speak from that, you know, group from Salem. But, you know, I don't know about the other churches, mm. you know. A lot of people I know quite a few people who live here in Roanoke that attend church in, you know, in Salem. Because it's a family church, you mm. know. They might live here or in the county, but they go back to Salem every Sunday for church or something like that, so... But you know, I don't know. It's
mm-hmm. We got time for one more question.
One more question.
And another thing I was wondering was, like, was segregation any more, like, present in Salem, or was it about the same level?
You know, it's almost like the attitudes were a little different in Salem. There was segregation there, mm-hmm. but I can remember my husband, even as young as, I don't know, he's had white friends forever. Mm-hmm. You know, he had a next door neighbor, you know, growing up that he talked about, and he had, you know, black friends too, but I don't think I guess Salem is so small. Or they were so close-knit that everybody's just sort of got to know everybody. Like in my neighborhood, it was a big neighborhood, but everybody that lived in the neighborhood was black. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But in Salem, he did not, you know, there were white people that lived in his neighborhood or black people that lived, you know, maybe they lived two streets over from each other or on the next street over or something. The kids just came together, he said, and just kind of played with each other, you know. So, and they had a segregated swing area that, you know, that they used up mm-hmm. in Salem. And, you know, the blacks went to that, you know, swim area. So they had some things that were segregated. But they had more functions, you know, where the kids would come in contact with each other more often, you know. Like more often up there when he was growing up. I can remember him saying that. In fact, he has a friend now that he still sees, and, you know, they grew up in the same general neighborhood vicinity. So, I don't know. Just a little different. I don't know.
I guess it's the difference between 35,000
and 5,000. Yeah, and 5,000. You know, it's a little different. You know, compact area, you know, so yeah. I think it's different. Okay, I hope I...